It's time for the Mac Geek Gab, and listener Kiwi Graham brings us our quick tip of the week with, for those who are trying to be paperless but still receive occasional physical documents or receipts and invoices, the Files app on your iPhone or iPad has a scan document feature. Even better is that it has a shortcut which can be added to the home screen to give it a one-touch ready to scan. It's not all that complicated of a setup. Open Shortcuts. Scroll down to the list of apps that have shortcuts until you get to the Files app. Tap and hold on the scan document icon and then choose to add it to the home screen. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab number 1033 for Monday, April 15th, ouch, text day, 2024.
Welcome to Mac Geek Gab, indeed, here on April 15th, which in addition to being tax day is also National Anime Day here in 2024. Sponsors. Oh, well, this show, because I almost forgot to tell you what we do here on this show. We share quick tips like Pete just did. We share your questions. We try to answer those questions. We share cool stuff found so that we can all learn at least five new things every single time we get together. Sponsors for this episode include coda.io/MGG. That's where you can go and sign up for free to bring all your text and tables together. And backblaze.com/MGG, where you can, yes, go get a fully featured, no risk free trial of this fantastic backup software. We'll talk more about both of those things and a whole lot more in a little bit. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And here also in New Hampshire is Pilot Pete. Good to be back with you guys after a week's hiatus, flying horses all over the country.
You were actually, I wasn't sure if I could mention that last week. You were actually flying horses across
flying
the country.
Flying show horses, yeah.
That's amazing.
It's very cool. Beautiful animals. They get, well, you know, you kind of, if you're going to spend the kind of coin to ship a horse on an airplane, it's probably a beautiful animal.
I would love to know what that number is. My guess is you don't even know what that number is. So
I asked, but in the interest of,
yes,
yeah, it ain't free. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I know.
It wasn't as much as I thought.
I've shipped a horse by land,
by truck,
by truck before, from Texas to Connecticut and the other direction, I believe too. But yeah.
I bet that wasn't free.
Also not free. Yeah. It turns out. Yeah. It's cheap. It's cheaper to relocate your stuff cross country and a car combined than it is to relocate a horse across the country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. They have them in these modified AMJs, and I don't know what AMJ stands for, but it's these huge cargo cans that fit on an airplane. They're kind of quarter pie shaped. They're rounded on the side that goes against the fuselage. And then there's two stalls in there. They walk the horses into those stalls, close the back door. So it's much like a horse trailer.
It's a horse trailer in the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I bet you appreciated having the extra horsepower on the plane there, Pete.
Almost as bad as my spam joke a few weeks back.
Always extra horsepower here at Mac Geek Gab. In fact, you have some extra horsepower to add to that quick tip that we started with, don't you, Pete?
I do. I actually like to use, or have been using for years, although I'm going to play some more with the one that Kiwi Graham gave us. I use an app called Genius Scan. It has both a free and a paid mode, and that's how I get most of my documents, paper documents, into PDF format. You can put it in folders. You can share it via numerous apps. So you use Synology Drive, or you can text it to somebody, that sort of thing. So
I used to use Genius Scan and PDF Scan, I think was the app from Smile, to do this. Especially where I really started using these things was years ago, scanning the paper score, like the drum chart for theater shows, because I wanted to get it into my iPad. I was like the first guy here, the first musician here on the seacoast of New Hampshire using an iPad on stage now, or in the pit. Now, everybody uses an iPad in the pit. Like it's, but it was ridiculous. Even as recently as 10 years ago, you couldn't get PDFs from the companies that you know, you rent. When you put on a theater show, there's these companies like MTI and others that you license the show from them. It's like, assuming you didn't write the show, you know, somebody else wrote, you know, whatever, you know, Rock of Ages or
Sound of Music.
Sound of Music, whatever. Yeah, whatever you're doing. And you license this and you pay a fee based on the size of the theater and the number of seats you have and probably many other factors that go into this. And then as part of the license, of course, you get the libretto, which is the thing that tells the actors what to speak and sing. And then you get books, scores, you know, one for the conductor that has everything. And then the drummer gets the drummer score, the guitar player gets the guitar player score, et cetera, et cetera. And they always came as paper books. And you had to write in them, and then you had to erase them at the end of the show before you sent them back. Otherwise, they would charge you for this, which was ridiculous. And so as soon as I like did a theater show after I was in iPad world, it had been like 20 years since I had done theater, and then I got roped into doing a show for a friend and was like, all right. So I converted it to iPad with this, and now you can get PDFs from the various licensing houses because they've realized – you got to catch up with the times. However, I used to use PDF Scan and Genius Scan to do this. We even talked about it here on the show, how amazing it was because you could like hold it up to a page. It would auto scan the page. You flip the page, it auto scans the next page. So I didn't have to press any buttons on my phone. That scan functionality in the iPhone now has all of that. It will auto crop the page.
It's crazy, right?
It just so knows. And you can do the same thing. You're just flipping pages, and it really does a great job of straightening things and getting it right.
Curve correction.
All of that.
I love that.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And ironically, the show that I did when I first scanned it, it was a show called Next to Normal. And there was a website where people would share these for free. You know, no one was charging for it. But if you scanned a book, you'd put it up there. So I uploaded it because I couldn't find it, you know, when I first went. Those apps initially didn't do a great job at straightening and all that. And there was one page in the score that was like a little funky for me, but it was fine. I knew it and like, whatever, you know, it was fine. I did that same show 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And the music director sent out the PDFs that he had found for everyone. And he literally sent me the PDF that I had created like 10 years prior. Like, Andrew, I made this. He's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, so, yeah.
I can tell by that one screwed up page.
Because by that one screwed up page. Yeah, exactly. Oh, he's like, that's really funny. Yep. Yeah. So, but yeah, I never thought about using a shortcut to like create a button to do that. I always just like do it. I do it inside the files app, but.
That's what I used to.
Yeah. Yeah, which is nice because then you have a spot where you like. I go to the folder where I want to save it, and then it just does it. But
yeah,
it does a great job, right? So
yeah.
Should I take us to Larry?
Yeah, let's do some questions. I know we always start with quick tips, but let's start with some questions, please.
Okay. Yeah. So Larry said, I went out of town this past weekend and stayed at a hotel that I had stayed at many times over the years. This time I took my 14-inch MacBook Pro M3 instead of my 10.9-inch iPad Pro. I also took two iPhones. The first thing I do when I get to the room is to connect my iPhones and iPad to the hotel Wi-Fi, usually with no problems. This time I had no problems with the iPhones, but lots of problems with the MacBook Pro. The procedure is to connect the phone or the MacBook Pro to the Wi-Fi, and the web page opens in the browser for me to accept the service. Everything went well with the iPhones, but not on the laptop. When I enabled Wi-Fi, I did not get a browser page asking for me to accept the service. Instead, I got nothing but a note on the Wi-Fi page saying that Wi-Fi was unsecured, and the MacBook Pro did indicate that the computer was connected to Wi-Fi. But when I tried to access a web page, I got a notice that I was not connected to the internet.
Yep.
I tried everything I could think of to no avail. I rebooted a couple times into safe mode, no change. I removed all the extensions from my browser, Firefox, with no change. Changed browsers to Safari and Chrome. Still no internet. I'm at a loss as to what I need to change. I'm running Mac OS 14.4.1 with 16 gigs of memory, 512 gigabyte SSD, and I have connected to a local community Wi-Fi with no password with no problems. This is the first time I've taken this MacBook Pro on a trip and tried to use it in place of my iPad. Any suggestions to help would be very much appreciated. I have not contacted Apple support yet in the hopes that one of you fine podcasters will have the answer. Dave, I think you have the answer. I could be wrong.
Well, I don't know if I have the specific answer for Larry, but I know what I would do if I were in Larry's shoes, which is
there you go.
Sort of my default. It's our default way of approaching your questions when they come in. I mean, if we know the specific answer, we'll answer it. But otherwise, it's here's what I would do next if I were there. So I oftentimes this happens because as soon as your computer starts to connect to the internet, as soon as it realizes it has an IP address, it starts trying to load all of the things that it needs on the internet. And that includes, you know, your mail, your whatever, right? Whatever apps are open, or whatever things are running in the background, it includes your browser too. Every web page these days is secured with we see HTTPS, we see the little lock in the URL bar, and when you visit one of these captive portal pages for the hotel, the way the hotel delivers that to you is it sees that you're trying to load another web page. And then it redirects that page. It says, no, I'm going to hijack this lookup for this page and show you my captive portal page instead. And in a sense, that's what we want to have happen. We don't like it when our browser stuff is hijacked. But in these scenarios, that's what needs to happen. And the nice part about this is this way, you don't need to know what the magic URL is to load the hotel's captive portal page, because it's going to be, you know, it might even just be at an IP address / you know, whatever, like you don't know. So this hijacking auto redirects you to the hotel's page and you don't need to know. It just says, oh, I'm going to take you there. Great. The problem is your browser, it doesn't like it when a secure page is hijacked because it sees the security certificate doesn't match with where you have been brought, and it stops. And that's the end of that.
You get a nice blank page.
You sometimes, or you get the
or
the,
no page,
or you get the warning that, you know, that it's unsecure or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so the way to get around this is to ensure that you load a non-secure page. If in fact that's the problem, and this might not have been Larry's problem. We'll talk about other reasons that this might happen too. But if in fact this was Larry's problem, the way you get around it is you load a page that's not HTTPS. Of course, none of the places that we visit are HTTP anymore. Everybody's using HTTPS, and that's a good thing. So I always type neverssl.com into my browser toolbar, and as you might guess by the name of the website, it is never SSL. That means it's never HTTPS, it's never secure, it's always sent in the clear, and therefore your browser is okay redirecting to whatever the captive portal in the hotel, on the plane, all of those things. So that would be step one for me, is to visit neverssl.com. And it is always going to be http://neverssl.com. It's never HTTPS. And Apple tries to do this in the background too, right? They have, is it captive.apple.com? Do either of you know
yes.
what the, okay.
I remember that. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. PJ put it in the Discord.
Ah, there it is. Yeah. So, yeah. Yep. Yeah. So if you remember captive.apple.com, that also would work. Yeah, exactly. I think never SSL predates it, or at least in my memory, it was the first thing baked in there. So that's what I type, and it's easy to remember because it's never SSL. So that's one way that
does
you get around it. Go on.
It does. A lot of browsers now will force things back to HTTPS, but that won't happen with these.
It doesn't. No, at least I haven't had that issue. I, you know, usually I'll go to my browser URL bar and type never SSL. And because I've visited it before, it knows that it was HTTP, right? And so it works just fine. If it's your first time visiting it, you might need to type in the full http://neverssl.com and hit enter just to sort of cement that in your browser's history.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
I forget where I was recently, Singapore or Dubai or something. But I went to one hotel and I've got that little GLI MT3000 travel router, which is nice because some of the hotels will limit you to 2 or 3 connections, that sort of thing. So if you take that router, you've got all the connections you want because you only have one.
Yeah, right.
Portal. Yep. But this one, I forget which hotel it was, and I wish I had remembered now, because no matter what I did, I tried captive.apple.com and never SSL and all, and it would not get me to a login portal. I could get there on my laptop and I could get there on my iPhone, but the router would not let me have it. And that's what I've used on that router at other hotels.
Right.
So
that router's weird. I love the idea of that Barrel AX router, the implementation of it. I don't know. Like when we were trying to use it in Vegas, it was like, all right, well, this is slowing us down massively.
Yeah,
that's a bad idea.
20 megabits per second, I think, or something like that.
Oh, that's right. When we were doing it in Vegas, because most hotels, and certainly the hotel that we were in there did this, will limit bandwidth per connection.
Yeah.
Right. So that no one person or no one device is, chewing up all the bandwidth, and it leaves room for other people. Like, it's really smart. The problem is if you have that barrel router connected,
you got one connection.
It is one connection. Right.
So 10 of you get 2 each.
You get to share that one connection. And plus, we also it added a hefty amount of latency. Like I want to say it was 50 or 60 milliseconds of latency versus just connecting directly to the hotel Wi-Fi.
The nice thing for me was, though, I'm able to watch it. I was able to use the VPN on it.
Right.
And appear to be coming from home and able to watch my TV services through that.
So the router, the router itself has a VPN connection?
Yes. And then of course it's died on me. I've got a support ticket in on that.
Of course. It's a good idea. I like it.
So
go ahead, Adam.
If this is a certificate issue, like a non-matching certificate, SSL certificate issue, I might have another tip, because I have to use this with web development all the time, because I do self-signed certificates for different like local development and stuff like that. So there's a trick in Chrome when that white page comes up that you're talking about, Pete. So you try to hit something, right? And it's like blocked by SSL. And there's usually a link on in Chrome, at least, if you use Chrome.
Yeah, I know the dangers.
That says,
keep going.
Bypass it. That even doesn't always work. So if you're still stuck on the white page, Chrome has this thing where you can type, "This is unsafe." Just while you're on that white screen, there's no input box, nothing to tell you this. You just type that all one word. I think also maybe bad idea, all one word works, but I always use "this is unsafe," and that will bypass it.
What?
Yeah.
Like there's no, you're like, you don't see that
it's a
happening.
Developer thing. You just have to know it. Yeah. You just have to know you can type, "This is unsafe," all one word, lowercase.
It's lowercase. Okay, that was my question. Yeah, I found a Stack Overflow post. Yeah. Oh, what? I had no, I love this. Now
it's only
I want to go
this
use
is a
it.
Chrome thing.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Whoa. Oh, I like that. I'm glad I did this. I'm glad I woke up to do the show today. This is great. Wow.
Yeah, right? That's a definite.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If it's not this, it could be your DNS settings. If you've got some weird DNS, and actually I have another thought as to what this would be, but I'll stay on this track here. If you've set some custom DNS in your Wi-Fi settings, remove that. Let the hotel's DHCP server give you its DNS address, because you might need that to get to the captive portal. Some of them, it depends on how it's set up. But yeah, you'd go into, system settings, Wi-Fi. Where is it buried in there? They change it all the time. System settings, Wi-Fi, details, And then I think it's, DNS. Remove your custom DNS servers from there. And that might be the magic answer for you. So that's idea number two. Idea number three, turn off your VPN. If you've got, I've had this problem with PIA VPN where it tries to protect you. And so it doesn't let traffic pass until the VPN is connected, right? And the VPN can't connect if you haven't broken through the captive portal yet. And so you wind up in this chicken and egg scenario. And it can be a trick to convince PIA to stop trying to connect and blocking you. So, be diligent. I think once I even fully uninstalled PIA to bypass this because it was such a PIA.
Wow.
Yep. no pun intended.
PITA.
PITA, maybe, sure. Be aware of your VPN. That might actually be what's going on with Larry here. Now that I'm thinking through all this.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
The other thought that I had, although because I'm going to say this probably wasn't it because his iPhones or iOS devices connected just fine. Does technologies like Private Relay potentially cause any issues with this? If it's like masking your IP, like do certain captive portables act differently and be like,
maybe
you're not really part of my network and I'm not going to like let you do this. Right.
Maybe. Yeah. Yep. And Porthos John points out that tail scale can also get in the way of this, especially if you have it set to use an exit node, like as the default. So yeah, these are all great ideas. Yep. But this is the way you got to kind of get your brain into thinking like, what's in the way between me and the internet? What have I put in the way between me and the internet? Ask that question. Right.
Right.
Because, you know, like, what was it? John had a problem years ago with, what was that app that would like tell Little Snitch?
Little Snitch, yeah.
You could have it tell you what was going on, but you could also have it block things. It's good. So, all right. Well, that was, about 14 minutes on the first question, guys. So,
it was a good question and there's a lot there. And
it is. Yeah. It's, I love digging in like this.
Though yep. I do wish you'd gotten to the whole PIA thing earlier in that question. Cause if someone stopped listening, that's huge. Go back and find that.
Yes.
Getting rid of PIA. Yeah. I've had that block me before and you're like, oh, no wonder I can't get on the portal.
Yep. Yep.
So.
All right.
Well, should we stick with more networking?
Go.
Because I have something from Jim.
Great.
Jim says, I have Comcast cable in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I have fairly good Wi-Fi speeds in the house. Until recently, I also had adequate speeds in another room off the freestanding garage. Now, the indoor speed remains good, but there is very little transmission to the garage room outside. I have a Netgear Nighthawk router, which is over 5 years old, but appears to be functioning well. I suspect loss of transmission distance may be related to having too many devices hooked up to the internet. I would assume the distance has been compromised by too many units using 2.4 gigahertz. Do you think this problem can be managed with the router, or should I just switch over to mesh?
Yeah. $700, do it.
Just throw money at the problem.
Right?
You got to throw money. The right money at the problem. You want to start with this, Pete?
Yeah, so I know you answered Jim's question here as well.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts, but go ahead. Yeah.
My first thought on this was, has anything new been added to the network? Some kind of a bandwidth hog, like a 4K streaming TV, a teenager gaming, something like that. But again, it's weird because this whole question was about inside and I think like a shed or something nearby. And so the 2.4 band, gigahertz band is good at getting through walls, but it's more subject to interference. You know, as soon as someone turns on a microwave what we couldn't do, I assumed that he was kind of isolated, saying he was in the mountains, but does he have a neighbor nearby? And so it's consider changing the channels on your 2.4 gigahertz Band.
Yep.
Is another one. And I think he wrote back and said, we talked to him about getting a Wi-Fi extender or repeater. And I think he wrote back and said he tried that, but it was not fruitful. So, and then the other suggestion I had was consider before going mesh, just try getting another router that's Wi-Fi 6. You know, those are my initial suggestions to try. And the other one was, you know, hey, pull everything off the network, add it back one at a time and see what the culprit is. But that could get real difficult. There's a lot of things on my network.
Oh, that, you know, but there is, like, I like this idea of isolate and troubleshoot, right? So sure. One thought is to kind of tack on to that, Pete, is rename your network and just connect one device to it, right? Your phone, whatever, something that you know, your Mac would be even better because you can run like Wi-Fi Explorer and see what's going on.
Sure.
But that way you will at least rule out or rule in this theory that maybe it's because you have too many devices connected to the network. I mean, all your other devices will temporarily anyway fall off the network if you change the name of your network. But that's sort of the point, right? Then you walk around with the one device that you connect to the new network, test things, confirm, refute, log, capture data, and then, you know, from there you can kind of go and test other things. But that was not on my radar at all, but I love this idea of like, let's just make sure it's not the Wi-Fi having trouble itself, because if it is, that's one direction. If it's the multiple devices, that's a different direction to solve. And I think if it's multiple devices and that's the problem, which I don't think so. But again, like, this is a 5-minute test to rule that out. It costs you nothing other than time. So, and just make sure other people in the house know that they're going to fall off the network, there you go. Yeah. Porthos John in the chat saying you can even try a guest network and use only the 5 gigahertz radio or only the 2.4 gigahertz radio, right? Like you can, in many routers, not all, you can isolate and turn off one radio or turn off the other or give each different SSIDs and test them different ways. And so leverage the features of your router to test multiple SSIDs and multiple radios with only one device and see what that gets you. That would, but it is, Wi-Fi is a guessing game. But my feeling is if it used to get enough signal outside and now it doesn't, I don't think it's the Wi-Fi, the number of Wi-Fi devices. I like to your point, Pete,
right.
It was there a neighbor that added a new router, right? That's like getting in the way and
same channel.
Yeah. Wi-Fi Explorer is my current favorite app, it's part of SetApp. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, Wi-Fi Explorer is great at looking at what is around you because you don't get to see that with Wi-Fi. So it can help you. And then just think about what else changed.
I mean, a 5-year-old Nighthawk should still be cranking pretty good.
Yeah.
Is not that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Mm-hmm. He said, it's not going to be 6E, right? It's probably going to be Wi-Fi 5 if it's 5 years old, you know, but it'll be using 5 gigahertz and 2.4 gigahertz. And in theory, you know, the question is what changed. And I suppose it could be that something happened to the radio in your router. Like, did the antenna come loose? Like, could be one of those things too. I don't,
Did one transistor burn out?
Go ahead, Adam.
I said, or it's the stack of cordwood he put up against the freestanding garage.
it could be a lot of things.
Did you build a Faraday cage around your garage?
Yeah, did you put a new refrigerator in your garage that wasn't there before that now is blocking signal or, you know, something else? In our house, we, you know, our foundation is cement. Our house is kind of a the basement is walk out on one side, right? And that one side is where we put in a patio a couple of years ago. It has been an interesting experience getting Wi-Fi to shoot through either the window or the door, because it ain't shooting through the cement that surrounds everything else, just to get Wi-Fi on the patio so that we can, you know, listen to music.
Because there's rebar in there.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have a Faraday cage.
I do. Yeah. It's crazy, like, how well it works to insulate that. Like, Yeah. It's been a learning experience. But that's, you know, that's what we do here. So, yeah. That's, yeah. So hopefully that gets us somewhere. Yep. All right. Shall we move on from networking to not networking?
Yeah, sure. Keyboards.
Okay. You want to take us to Dean, Adam? I think, right? Or am I reading that one? No, you're reading that one.
I got Dean.
Great.
Yeah. So Dean says, is it possible or is there an app in which I can reprogram the function row key, the FN row key, on a Magic Keyboard? For example, I have use F1, F2 keys, etc. as standard function keys disabled. So when I press F4, it actually triggers Spotlight. I'd like to reprogram this to either run a hotkey for or launch Raycast instead. Not sure if this is possible or that critical either. It just came to mind and I figured, who better to ask? As always, keep up the hard work. Love the show.
Thanks, Dean. I think anybody who's listened for even a short period of time to this show knows what I'm going to say, and it's Keyboard Maestro is where I would go to do this, and it will do this. I'm certain there are other apps that will also do this, but the one that I have installed and that I use is Keyboard Maestro, and yeah, absolutely, you can use it to remap just about anything you want. So,
well, yeah, I have a question. Will it do that even when it's in the non-standard mode, like he has it, or do you have to flip it back over to non-standard mode so Keyboard Maestro sees that as an actual function key? Like,
that is a good question. Because
I'm wondering if the nuance of this is he wants to be able to do that, but still maintain, say, the other hotkeys. So, like, maybe he's not using the Spotlight one, but he still wants to use his volume and media controls.
Well, I think it's worth testing this, but what I would do is swap them around and then program Keyboard Maestro to capture and trigger all of them. And so when you hit the volume up key, it's really hitting whatever, you know, function 12,
right. Yeah.
And let Keyboard Maestro capture function 12 and make it volume up. And then you could even do you want it to be a normal volume up? Do you want it to be a half increment of volume, which is a thing you can do, right? Like, so, but that's a good question. Yeah, you might have to, it might be an all or nothing kind of thing. So,
yeah.
I
would add also, if you may already have Better Touch Tool.
Yes. Yep.
Another great app for remapping.
So. Yeah, and that might even be, it might have a simpler interface to do this. Yeah. I don't know. I'm too used to Keyboard Maestro at this point.
Well, and the beauty is, right? How many YouTube tutorials out there?
Yeah.
On to use either one or both of those.
That's fair.
So.
That's fair. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They're it, you know, it's like we were talking about, I can't remember. Were we talking about in the show or before? I don't even remember. Oh, yeah, in the show, I think. You know, some apps aren't intuitive out of the gate, but you know, once you learn them, then they become intuitive to you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Better Touch Tools in Setup.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I just found that out. And it looks like there's one called Keysmith in there. Create a shortcut for any action.
All right.
Yeah. I just typed in keyboard remapping.
Yeah.
In Better Touch Tool. And I mean, in Set App. And it looks like a half a dozen options popped up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's right. There's a jillion of these out there. So, yeah. Yep. Think about which one you might already have installed and be using and stick with that would be the first step.
Keep it simple.
You got it. All right. You want to take us to Porthos John here, Pete?
I can do so. Will I type it into notes really quickly?
While you vamp? So,
yeah, exactly. Which one was it?
It's the last one.
Still get through.
Yeah, that's the one.
Airplane mode.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Oh, there it is. Okay. Porthos John writes in and asks, does anyone know if there are any other negative effects to running in airplane mode with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth enabled? Obviously, when I'm at home, is anything besides cellular disabled? Do I miss SMS messaging?
So this was I was sitting on the couch when I saw this question come into MacGeekGab.com/Discord. And my first thought was, I don't know, I haven't tested that. I was like, well, no better time than the present. So I put my phone into airplane mode. I waited a minute to really make sure that it was actually in airplane mode. And then I logged into our Google voice account for MacGeekGab that we have, which is 224-888-GEEK. We have a phone number that you can leave voicemails at. You can also leave text messages. And so I did the reverse. I had it send me, I sent myself a text message from us. And sure enough, it showed up on my phone. I made sure that airplane mode was on. Wi-Fi calling had activated itself in airplane mode. And that's the trick here. And once it did that, yeah, it was registered as though it were with the cell network far enough anyway to get SMS in and out. I was able to reply to it and the SMS went out. And this tracks, right? Because when I've traveled overseas and I don't have roaming service for phone or SMS, as long as I'm on Wi-Fi, it will work. I'm also told, I need to test this, that if you have a secondary SIM, like an eSIM, a data-only eSIM, it will use that in a Wi-Fi calling-esque kind of way. It won't say Wi-Fi calling, I don't think. It might, I don't think so. But okay. It will use, like, if I have my Mint Mobile SIM here in the U.S. and I go and I get, like, a whatever SIM in Europe, it will use the whatever SIM's data to send and receive SMSs. I can't confirm that because I haven't, I may have tested this inadvertently and not realized it in the past, but it will use that data now. I'm told it will use that data as kind of the backdoor Wi-Fi calling-ish to let that through, which makes sense. I mean, it's data is data. Like, it doesn't matter if it's Wi-Fi or something else. It should be able to, like, piggyback on that. And it sounds like Apple has made that work. So
what I found interesting is, now I wouldn't try this on some because you're going to get some wild international charges coming back to meet you. But on Mint, because it's a prepaid, if you don't have international, if you haven't paid for international,
yep.
I've actually learned that if I just try to do Wi-Fi calling from a hotel Wi-Fi, frequently I'll get, you need to turn cellular on, or some error message that won't let me call out. I turn the cellular on and the Wi-Fi calling picks up. So if you're overseas and you're on Mint where you won't get billed, or some other prepaid, then go ahead and turn on your cellular. Let it connect to a cellular network using that SIM and the Wi-Fi calling will pick up and work. I don't know why that does that. It should be able to do it without the cell data or the cell on.
Should be
able to do Wi-Fi calling. But for some reason, it doesn't. And then along those lines, Dave, I don't know if I just saw it yesterday. Minternational.
Yes.
They just cut their price in half. And it actually looks like a fair price now. I'm going to start using it.
I agree with that. Yeah, it's the Minternational is Mint Mobile's newest
international data.
International plan. It's call. Data, phone call, and SMS. You can't piecemeal it anymore like you used to be able to. And they were charging a fortune for it. It was like $40 for 10 gigs for 10 days, which is like, no. But now it's $20 for 10 gigs for 10 days. And then there's other shorter plans with less data that are also similarly priced. And $20 for 10 gigs is more expensive than you could find for data only in most places. However, it's not that much more. It's, you know, maybe it's double, right? Maybe it's $10 more. But for the convenience of it, I'd probably just use that. And I think they know this. And if you're going to Mexico, there ain't no way you're going to get 10 gigs for $20. That's going to be more like 30. I don't know why Mexico data is more expensive than everywhere else I've ever traveled. But so I don't know why. Like, it doesn't make sense to me, but it is what it is. So, I will almost certainly use this when I travel now that they've brought the prices in. Because in addition to the data, you get, I think, 500 texts and 500 voice minutes or something, you know, to use internationally, too. So,
and I thought I saw it was on the one I was looking at yesterday that it was unlimited data, but you know, like 10 gigs of 5G. That's what it was, you know. So, but then after that, well, of course, you know what, they're unlimited data. If you're on like a 10 gig plan and you use the 10 gigs, the rest of your data is unbelievably slow.
I didn't see that, but I didn't look deep enough at it to see it. Didn't it looked
trying to call it up.
Yeah, it looked like it's not being. Yeah, here it is. It's unlimited data with 10 gigs of high speed data. You're not wrong. And the 3-day plan is unlimited data with 3 gigs of high speed data. Yes. All right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, so you, even once you hit your limit, you still get, like, you could still get a text message, you know, a WhatsApp message through, like, you're probably not going to want to surf the web, but you could, you know, you've got something. Huh. All right. Nice catch.
And,
wow.
Yeah. And 3 days for $10. Yeah. I could do that.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, folks, here we are swooping in with a tale of digital doom averted thanks to our cyber superhero and our sponsor, Backblaze. Picture this: 3 techies, terabytes of crucial data, and the ever-looming cloud of data disaster overhead. Sounds like a job for Backblaze. With unlimited cloud backup for just $99 a year, it's like having an invisibility cloak for your data, shielding it from the dark arts of digital demise. Now, deploying Backblaze across our tech fortress was a breeze, even easier than convincing Adam that pineapple does go on pizza. Wait, no, it doesn't. ChatGPT told me to say that. I don't like pineapple on pizza. And for Pete, flying through the cloud isn't just a day job. It's ensuring our data's always within arm's reach, whether we're grounded or at 30,000 feet. But here's the kicker. When disaster struck my hard drive like lightning, Backblaze was my phoenix from the ashes. With their rapid recovery, my data was back before my tea went cold. And if you prefer your backups tangible, they'll ship you your data on a hard drive. Return it within 30 days for a full refund, making the best return flight your data will ever take. So don't get caught in the turbulence of data loss. Glide smoothly into backblaze.com/MGG for a no-risk free trial, and tell them the Mac Geek Gab crew sent you. Again, go to backblaze.com/MGG where you, Mac Geek Gab listeners, get a fully featured no-risk free trial. Go there, play with it, start protecting yourself from potential bad times. Start today, and our thanks to Backblaze for sponsoring this episode. You ever feel like your project management tools are more like juggling flaming torches while blindfolded? Well, douse those flames and take off the blindfold, because our sponsor Coda is here to turn your chaotic circus into a well-oiled machine. Imagine a world where documents, spreadsheets, and apps all live in harmony under one digital roof. That's Coda. It's like having a Swiss Army knife for your productivity, but instead of a tiny, hard-to-use saw, you've got sleek, powerful tools that actually get the job done. Here at Mac Geek Gab, we're not just tech enthusiasts, we're collaboration connoisseurs. Over the years, we've used Coda as our tool for keeping the podcast gears turning smoothly no matter where we are in the world. It's kind of like having your own digital studio where ideas flow as freely as Pete's puns during the recording sessions. I know. With Coda, setting and tracking your goals isn't just easy, it's practically a team sport. And the best part, you're always scoring. Plus, with access to a treasure trove of templates, you're never at a loss for inspiration. It's like being given the map to productivity treasure island. So don't get caught flipping between tabs like a confused DJ. If you want a platform that empowers your team to collaborate effectively and focus on shared goals, you can get started with Coda today for free. Head over to coda.io/MGG. That's coda.io/MGG to get started for free. Coda.io/MGG. Dive into Coda's world and discover how easy and integrated work life can be. It's the upgrade your workflow's been waiting for. And our thanks to Coda for sponsoring this episode.
All right. Some of you will be old enough to get this reference.
Okay.
I almost renamed S-Lady to Frasier. Go ahead, Pete. I'm listening. And all she would do was listen. She would not respond. It was really bizarre. No matter what I did, I had that little floating ball at the bottom of my iOS screen, and S-Lady would listen and listen and listen and never give a response. Beat my head against the wall a few times, and then finally went and looked it up, the answer. Disable Siri. Oops, S-Lady. Sorry. Disable her, reboot the phone, and then re-enable. You're going to have to set her up again and say, you know, all the 10 phrases that it asks you to say to set it up. And then it worked great again. At first, I thought it was, I bought one of those little CarPlay modules, yeah. Wireless CarPlay.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's just not connecting right. But I'm like, no, I've got the little ball there that says it's listening. And it wouldn't respond. So I thought that was the issue at first. And then I realized, no, it's every time I try to use it, it's not working. So disable Siri, reboot the phone, and re-enable, reset it up, and things work great. I have no idea what stray bit got in there
to
turn off the response. Huh. So if you're having listening issues, go ahead. I'm listening.
Yeah, right. Yeah, go ahead.
That's all I'm going to do is listen.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. Yep.
Which was, you know, I think I talked about it at one point. My wife asked why I was whispering. I said I didn't want the A-Lady in that, to over. I didn't want Jeff Bezos to hear me or something. And my wife laughed. A-Lady laughed. Siri laughed.
Yeah. Anything to add to that one, Adam, before we move on here?
No, please. Yeah. I was wondering if you do that. I can't remember if you lose the training or not. Like Siri learns stuff about you over time. I don't know if that gets reset or not.
Interesting.
Probably.
I would think it would, but you never. Well, it's connected to your account, right?
It's tied to iCloud, yeah. So you might not. It might be totally safe.
Yeah. Huh. Well,
worth considering.
Yeah, you'll find out
if you need to do it.
Yeah, right.
I've done it before. I've reset that. Done the same thing, Pete. I've had it happen to me years ago, and just same trick, right? I found the same thing. Turn it off, reboot, turn it back on. Yeah. You retrain it, and you're back up and going.
Steve has a bit of a PSA for us. He says, I've run afoul of a little known rule, at least to Steve and me. I didn't know about this, concerning Apple's family sharing system. Every once in a while, the family sharing preferences panel gets wonky with incorrect pictures and owner family member designations. And the solution for that has always been to quit family sharing, log out of it, straighten out the errors in the two accounts between me and my wife, and re-enable family sharing. Last week, he says, I was met with an error that I could not use family sharing with my wife for another 162 days. Evidently, having violated the rule that says you can only establish family sharing with another Apple ID account once every year for the second account. This is a costly problem for me as I have all the licenses for our software tied to my Apple ID. I dug around, and one suggestion was to see if my wife could initiate family sharing from her account. share with me, then the stuff I have, what's mine is hers, and all that was good. And we figured maybe that would work since she had not done this before. But going through it, we got the same error message. Her account is essentially locked out of family sharing as an organizer or guest for now. It's starting to look like the best remaining option to solve this problem is to open a brand new Apple ID for her on her new computer and initiate family sharing with that new account and then share it with Steve's account. And he talks about, you know, then it's like, okay, well, if I do this, what do I need to think about in terms of syncing data? And, you know, what am I going to lose? And the answer to all that other stuff is you're not going to lose anything. The other account stays where it is. You're not deleting the other account. You are simply creating a new one. You might want to create a, depending on what you have synced, you could either add your wife's old account as her secondary account, or because you can have a secondary iCloud account. You don't get everything. You don't get documents and data, but you do get contacts and calendars and things like that. Or create a new user on her computer and log her into that. And then that user will have access to all of her stuff. And you can sort of manually, you know, it's a headache. But I had no idea about this once a year thing with family sharing. I mean, I get it, but yeah.
Yeah. I think it's designed to, like, because you have that 6-person limit. So I think it's designed to help avoid, like, people adding people temporarily and then removing them and then adding them again and
that makes
swapping
sense.
Around accounts and stuff like that. Yeah, but I mean, it's again, it's one of those things where it probably mostly just catches people like this, somebody who's legitimately using the service, and it just becomes a giant pain in the, you know, there's a million of these kinds of things in our lives, and it just frustrates me to heck that it's like most of the time you're putting in checks and balances that are going to get the legitimate people caught, and the people who really want to bypass it are going to figure out some way around it.
They're going to figure out another way. Right. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It, he came up with a list. Like, this email was 4 pages long. And, after reading through the list, I had advice from him. It didn't work for him, but I still think it, you know, it might work for somebody else. So I'll share the gist of it. The gist is that we as people, not, you know, all of us, like to avoid pain, right? And so my thought was, take this, and what I told him was, take this email that you wrote me here and put it into a bullet list, like all the tasks that will need to be done, you know, in terms of how to get your wife's data in the right places if we have to sign up for this new account, and like make a big long list and book a Genius Bar appointment and go to the Genius Bar and show them the list and say, if you don't have someone at Apple that you can call to reset this lock on my wife's account, look at what you and I are going to get to do this afternoon together, because the Genius doesn't want to have to spend all that time with you. The Genius's manager definitely doesn't want the Genius having to spend all that time with you. And so that incentivizes, they get to pick the least painful path, which I was hoping was, hey, I know somebody I can call. They call, the unlock is done, problem solved, you get to walk away. You make your problem their problem. I always said when I was doing consulting, and I like still think this way whenever I'm helping somebody with their computer, you always want to be on the same side of the desk as the customer. Well, it's also true as the customer. You want to be on the same side of the desk as the person who's helping you, so that, you know, they'll stay with you, and you're doing this side by side, and by pulling the Genius to your side of the...
grab them by the scruff of the neck, pull them to your side of the table.
Yeah, exactly. And show them the pain that you see and make that pain their pain. And and he did try this, and it there was no magic, that magic button that anybody could push, but at least he found out that there was no magic button that anybody could push. So... I don't know.
I guess the last step is tcook@apple.com and share the story with him and be like, would you want to go through this?
That's
legitimately.
That's a, you know what? Yeah, Steve, take the email you sent to us and like loop in Tim. Yeah, absolutely. Like Adam said, tcook@apple.com. Unlike Steve, I don't think Tim triages a lot of his own email.
No, but he has people.
But someone does, and they do take this stuff. They do look at this stuff, whether they're going to.
They do.
Yeah, they do look at this stuff. And this is one of those things. I like that idea, Adam. Yeah.
Talk about going right to the head shed, huh?
I mean, you know.
Take it to the top.
Why not?
It's dumb.
It's dumb. Like, dumb.
And the more people that say this is dumb, this is really inconvenient, you know, and Apple does really care about that. They care about
customer satisfaction.
Processes that are just, well, you're just even dumb stuff. And yes, they're willing to admit mistakes when they make mistakes. At the very least, you know, maybe they add a policy where you can go to the Genius Bar and there is like an override exception thing, you know,
right,
when you call AppleCare in extreme cases. It, you know, they don't have to turn it off completely, but to Dave's point, there should be somebody at some level that can be like, okay, this is legit. Like,
yeah,
this person should not be going through this. Let's reset that.
Yeah,
that limit on this one account.
On this one account. That's right. And they could put in like software-based checks that say, okay, yes, he removed this user from this account. He didn't add anyone to the account in the interim. That account, the secondary, his wife's account, wasn't added to a different family sharing plan in the interim. He's just adding it right back the way that it was. And nothing about either of these two accounts has changed with regards to family sharing other than this one thing. Let it through. Don't even make it subject to the 180-day or the 1-year limitation or whatever it is. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a question for you, Adam. It comes from listener David, not me, but I actually am also curious as to your answer on this. He says, my wife plays a lot of games on her iPad. She has a non-game app called Happy Color. While in that app, she got a pop-up telling her that her iPad needed cleaning. She immediately brought it to me, and I just turned the iPad off and back on. Note, I am a retired accountant and took away her Windows PC and replaced with a Mac, and I also converted to a Mac. He says, I figured by making us Apple users with Macs, iPhones, and iPads, my tech support days might be over. Turns out, no. his question, should we be concerned with this pop-up on her iPad, and is there a malware app for the iPad that you would recommend we use? He says, I do use and love Clean My Mac for our Macs, which includes malware detection and removal. Is there something similar for the iPad, and do we need it? What do you think, Adam?
I mean, the short answer on the antivirus, you know, stuff, no, there is not one. And I'm of the opinion we probably don't need such a thing. Mainly because the way iOS has been set up from the very beginning, everything is so extremely siloed. And, you know, the one thing I might do is delete that one game app, you know, like get rid of that. It, you know, I think obviously there's some sort of phishing ad is what it feels like. And the reason that can still happen is because with ad supported apps, Apple does allow third party like ad services to be plugged into that. So depending upon whatever ad service the app developer partnered with, a lot of those, or I shouldn't say a lot of them, but there's times when an ad service like that is so automated that they're not really paying attention to the ads that get injected onto the network. They probably will catch it pretty quick and probably ban that person from the ad network that was throwing that ad in there. Right.
Right.
But stuff slips through. We see it on the internet, you know, with internet banners and stuff like that. Legitimate websites will get ads injected that, you know, are scammy or baitery or whatever you want to call it. So, you know, and there's so many third-party apps and so many coming out of places like China and stuff like that. It's just stuff can slip through, even with all of Apple's checks and balances through the App Store. You know, it could be even, again, a legitimate advertising service and somebody just slip through the system for, you know, a couple seconds. That's all it takes, right?
Wife
happened to be on there for the 5 minutes that ad was on there and they didn't catch it and it popped up. So yeah, and, you know, and a lot of these games, again, like there's a lot of junkware on the iOS App Store. I think that's a bigger problem. I think that's the thing that Apple needs to probably address is like quality of content and apps. And I know they go after it and it's probably almost insurmountable like task, those people that are tasked with like vetting all that stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of weird games out there. You know,
yeah,
so we'll see about that. Yeah. And they come from weird places. And so it falls in that same category of like we would talk to people on the Mac is like, know where your software is coming from, know who's writing it, know who's like, and so yes, iOS does have that problem. But again, because of all the gate, how gated it is, that app's going to be so isolated to not be able to do anything outside of the app itself. Probably the best thing to do is just dump that app, you know, just go bad app, you know, throw it away.
Yep.
I really liked everything you said up until the last part there, which was know who's writing your software and where it comes from. That's hard for a lot of users, not for us, because this is, we're into this. But I think the average person who just wants to use their phone and their computer, that's hard. And I guess the only answer to that is, I don't disagree. I just think it's hard to do unless you've got a major company or something that's, I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
If the game or the app is like set up in a way where like to advance, you have to be constantly like buying gems or timing out or waiting for something to happen, or like unless you don't wait, then you buy this or buy that. If it's got a crud ton of in-app purchases and you go look, I mean, every app on the App Store will say who the developer is. If you click on that and the developer has 3,000 apps exactly like this one in different variations, like these are hints that like this is
they're make it only all the way after level this one to get on you to do games, and then I ditch it. So yeah, you're right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and this is why, I mean, to your point about know who develops your app. Well, Apple knows who has developed the app, every app in the App Store,
in their App Store.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so there's that. And so you can, in a sense, offload that to Apple, although it, as we've said, it's not perfect. Yeah. And I realize that's what you were saying, Adam. But the other thing is to sort of address the point of all of those games that want you to buy gems and you know, pay or wait or like all of those things that add friction to the experience of playing a game. That's what Apple Arcade was developed for, was to give you games that aren't allowed to have any of that if they're going to be part of Apple Arcade. It's, nope, they're already being paid because it's a subscription, and take the money or don't. But, you know, this is the rule. This is the policy for being included in Apple Arcade. And so, I think that's the answer there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
And let me be fair to those junkware games. They deserve to exist. Like they are a thing, and they're not, and I don't want to give the impression that they're coming from malicious, bad, or not legitimate developers or companies. They just have a business model that's set up that way. And again, part of that business model also involves injecting ads from third-party ad services. Correct. And again, even if they're legitimate ad services, stuff can slip through. It's not going through Apple's, you know, Apple, I don't think it has their ad thing anymore, but, you know, that stuff's not as closely vetted, you know, in terms of it's being piped into that app from some third-party place.
Right.
And you're going to encounter that more with those kinds of apps, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So you're more likely to see something like this happen with that style of app than you are, say, with an app from, you know, a developer that's just, hey, this is my game, it's $4.99, pay for it, you know, and that's their model.
And play to your heart's content.
And you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Fair. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Apple put out a lot of press releases this week, Adam. We don't talk about every one of them, but one of them reminded me of you. When Apple said that spatial computing is coming to business with Apple Vision Pro, what are your feelings on that?
I have the immediate reaction is they're in a place right now with Vision Pro where they sort of, I think they were hoping they'd throw it out there and there'd be like all these use cases that sort of surfaced, you know?
Yep.
And I think that hasn't happened yet. And we're several months on and people are still kind of wondering, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, what is this thing actually for? And so I think they're putting out some PR to try and make this use case for it. And actually looking through this article, I get where they're coming from on this, because I think this is a legitimate place where, at least early on, early adoption, they're looking at verticals. And this makes sense, right? This is like business verticals that are like, hey, we can do remote training and remote learning with this thing. We can do specific kinds of collaboration. Like, I think they talk about Porsche engineers using it to collaborate on stuff. So like, these use cases in the early days, and especially with the cost of the device, it's more likely is if you can build these experiences and they work for productivity within business. And you'll notice too, as I was reading through it, a lot of them too are, because I think one of the challenges with the current version of the current technology is it's just not that comfortable to wear all day long. You know, I can wear mine 2 to 4 hours, and about after that, it just starts to get really, like, you know, heavy. You really start to notice. So, you know, this idea, like that original idea they showed in the keynote, where I'd be at my desk every day and I'd have all these virtual screens and I'd be sitting there 8 hours a day with it on, I don't think that's it. But yeah, if you're trying to collaborate on a thing that you're building, and you can create these AR experiences. And I think I heard that they are bringing, like, a big thing that was missing, and I don't know if this is talked about in this article, but a big thing that Vision Pro did not have that restricted this sort of thing that they're talking about here was, you didn't have shared AR VR experiences when it launched.
Yeah.
And Apple is adding that. So, like, there's the great app, and I can't remember the name, Jigspace. So Jigspace, you'd have the ability to like bring up this airplane engine, right, that you could then burst apart and look at the mechanics, or like an F1 race car, like life size, sitting in front of you. And it's incredibly realistic and incredibly immersive. But if, Dave, you and I wanted to look at that today, or when it launched, you would see your own, you'd launch the app and you'd see your version of it, and I could see my version of it, and we could talk about it. But those were independent.
Right.
Apple is adding the ability for developers to make that shared. So, like, you're standing over there, I'm standing over here, we're both looking at it in our own space, but if you go start picking it apart, I'm going to see that come apart, and I'm going to see, you know, so you can truly collaborate. And that, in a kind of business-to-business environment, especially in the remote world that we're moving into, I think, could be incredibly powerful. So I get where they're coming from on this. Is it really going to happen? We'll see, but I get why they're making this use case, because
it makes sense. Cost. Makes sense. And they do talk a lot about collaboration in this. But I think it's like coming real soon now, or at least it will be evolving, which is fine. Like, this is a public beta of this thing, essentially. I think they have another option, like they have another swing that they can take at the general public with this technology, as a, you know, here's what you'll want, right? As opposed to, here's what the early adopters are going to want as they experiment. They'll iterate on that, and then they'll launch, you know, the Apple Vision. Maybe it's not the Apple Vision Pro or the Apple Vision Mini, or, you know, some cute Apple name that describes the new thing. And I think they'll have enough that they can do, like, another launch of it, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's a great thing in here. They're showing, like, HVAC unit, you know, building systems training, right? And so you have your training app, you're reading about something, and then you literally hit a button, and then it overlays the entire system in your space. And now you can see the sprinkler system and the HVAC system, and you can click on it, and you can get more information, and, like, you know, remote training, those sorts of things. So, like, these are going to be, I think, the early things. I totally agree with what you say about public beta. I've talked about this for years. I think Apple has a bunch of products that they often bring out that are, I've always called it public R&D, where they're looking to do public R&D. Yes. And I think the Vision Pro is one of these. You know, I think the original, like, I always talked about the G4, little tissue box computer. What was that?
The cube.
I can't remember what it was. The cube. Right?
Yeah.
The cube was what enabled, in my opinion, Apple to develop thinner laptops. Like they had to really like figure out thermals and cooling and passive cooling, and like they learned a lot from that product, and it had a lot of issues. A lot of people bought it, you know, and I think same thing with like the original MacBook Air, which was really funky and had all kinds of issues. But
that's really like, interesting. I never thought about the cube as like perhaps something that really helped pave the way to Apple Silicon. Right. Yeah. I mean, all the problems that the cube had, we could point back and say, well, you know, fundamentally, the CPU had to run too hot in order to do the things that we would want a computer to do. And therefore, it, you know, even with all of Apple's thermal solving, it wasn't enough, right, for a lot of things. But, is that part of the path to Apple Silicon? I think it is. It's not the only path to it, of course, but it's certainly, you know, you can point at that and say, well, Apple Silicon in a cube would have worked a whole lot better.
Here's a problem to be solved.
Yeah.
These are technologies, in my opinion, that Apple puts out because other companies maybe aren't pushing the needle far enough forward. And so they look at this and they go, we're going to bring this thing out. We know it's kind of ridiculous. We know it's overpriced. We know we're not going to sell a ton of them. But we want to see, you know, because up until the Vision Pro, really AR, VR has been mostly about just games, if we're really honest. And what I like about this article is they're saying, okay, this is a different thing. We see more in this technology. We built the hardware to push the needle in that direction. Even we don't, they'll never say this, but, you know, I think even they don't really know what the application is.
No, they don't. Yeah.
But they wanted it in the marketplace so they could see where it goes, and that's how they iterate the next version. And they push everybody in that direction. So if you've noticed, like, now all the other companies are like, wait a minute, you know,
we need to do this market space to
compete in. And by having competition there, everybody moves forward and all the technology moves forward more quickly. Again, the cube, I think, was the same thing. Like, the Enlight laptops, even the iPhone to a certain degree, although I don't feel like the first generation iPhone was a public R&D project. Like, that was very well thought out for the most part. I guess the app thing we could talk about, but
it became overall, but I don't think Apple knew that it was going to be that when it launched.
No, but I think they knew that smartphones could be better, that a bigger thing than they were. And that one of the technologies to push that forward was going to be multi-touch, right? And not a keyboard, and like these radical ideas. And so Vision Pro has all these radical ideas in it, and they need it in the market space to push everything forward.
Makes sense.
More quickly, you know?
Did you know that the guy who invented multi-touch lives in your town, Pete?
Yes, you told me that, actually.
Yeah. Dean Rubin. He invented it when he was a grad student. At
MIT, right?
No, he got his undergrad from MIT. He was at Carnegie Mellon for his graduate work, and he developed it because he's a keyboard player, and he had this idea of playing music on a computer screen, but you needed multi-touch to do that. So you can find a thing. We published a thing at the Mac Observer years ago about him. I know Dean because I've played in bands with him. you would never know, but Dean's work was the reason that Apple lost their suit against Samsung, because Samsung went and dug up Dean's old work and said, nope, prior art, somebody else had it before you, Apple. And Dean had to like hire his own attorney to be represented and all this stuff. And he doesn't have a patent on it either. Neither does CMU. At the time, nobody.
Yeah. Nice to do something and wind up having to pay money
to pay for it
in the future.
Exactly.
Because someone else is in a lawsuit that doesn't involve you.
That doesn't involve you. That dragged you in. Yep. But so, anyway.
Thinking of other parties, though, involved in this, I just wanted to mention something. It's kind of in my wheelhouse. The other augmented reality that's going on right now in the world is a military use, which is the F-35. They've got that augmented reality helmet. If you want to see what's below you, you simply look down and you look right through your own legs, through the aircraft, and it's all projected right onto your visor. So wherever the pilot looks, He sees.
He sees.
It's like flying in a clear bubble.
I'll put a YouTube video to that F-35 AR helmet so that you can see what the pilots see. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Can own one for a mere 300 large.
Look, hey, suddenly the Apple Vision Pro doesn't look too expensive.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Hey, I don't know if you guys can hear it. My tornado siren is going off, and it is not First Friday.
Uh-oh.
So it's completely sunny outside, no wind.
Yeah, you're probably fine.
If you need to disappear, Adam, that's okay.
If I disappear, I'm just letting you guys know right now. If I suddenly run away,
that's why. Okay.
Yeah. So, Dave, Joe has a question, and Adam just blew away.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Ari has an interesting little thing, and I know we're kind of getting to the end of our time together here anyway.
Punchy.
Yeah. But Ari found a different thing, and he confirmed this with Apple. He says he describes it as a bizarre quirk. The M3 chip in a MacBook Air can support two external displays as long as the MacBook Air is in closed lid mode. Right. So MacBook Air can support two displays. One of them, if the computer's open, you get the internal display and one external display. Closed lid mode, two external displays. The same
chip. It's hard to type with the lid closed.
Well, sure. The same chip inside a MacBook Pro can only support one display in closed lid mode. It cannot do the two displays like the MacBook Air can. So put that in your hopper and smoke it. And, you know, well, it's just good to know. So thank you for sharing that, Ari, obviously. Yeah. I know we're towards the end here. It has been far too long since we've taken a minute to express our detailed thanks for those of you who are in our premium program here. And so I do want to just read through those of you whose contributions have come in since the last time we did this. And again, you can learn more about this at macgeekab.com/premium. It is not mandatory. It is very much appreciated. And so thanks to for $10 contributions, thanks to Frank in Tunbridge, Stephen in Plainfield, John in Vienna, Jason in Charlestown, Joseph in Marietta, Stephen in Costa Mesa, Wagner in Allen, Gary in Babylon, Robert in Columbiana, James in San Antonio, Warren in Gloucester, James in Melbourne, Chris in Chorleywood, Bill in, he's got an APO box, Jeff in Chesterton, Barry in Des Plaines, Timothy in West Windsor, Corey in Midlothian, Abel in Santa Rosa, Kevin in Edison, Jonathan in Plainsboro, Matthew in Forked River, Paul in Lawrenceville, Neil, I lost Neil. Oh, I know I had it. I know I had it. It's right there. Neil in West Hartford. Right, of course. Michael in Robbins, James in Amity Harbor, Santiago in Palm City, Phil in Summers, Mark in Coopersburg, Donald in Furlong, Frank in Voorhees, Nick in Mount Clemens, Scott in Bourbonnais, Cal in Russellville, Jeremiah in Edgewater, Brian in Southbury, John in Wake Forest. Thanks to all of you for your $10 contributions. Thanks to Bob and Lepesh for a $15 contribution. Absolutely. And for $25 contributions, thanks to Doug in Richmond, Pier Timo somewhere, Wayne in Waipahu, Domenico in Holbrook, Randy in Westport, David in Troutdale, Anthony in Burnmouth, Stephen in Linlithgow, Michael in Quebec, Bruce in Decatur, Sharon in Wesley Chapel, Fernando somewhere, Mike in Tempe, Ralph in Bangor, Jeffrey in Windsor, Jonathan in Woodside, Robert in West Hartford, Chris in Windsor, Susan in Honolulu, Michael in Omaha, Paul in Pomona, Michael in Woodbine, Graham in Glebe, Mike in Raleigh, William in Getzville, Craig in Pace, Robbie in Hendersonville, Craig in Costa Mesa, Andrew in Honolulu, Donald in Jamaica Plain, David in Chicago, Bryn in Sun City, Kurt in Tawanda, Ed in Torrance, Thomas in Garden Grove, Stephen in Manalapan, Kirit in Bloomfield Hills, Colby in Otis, Mark in New Palestine, Andrew in Bellingen, Rob in South Hurstville, Roger in North Charleston, and that's thanks to all of you for your $20 contributions, $30 contributions. Thanks to Robert in Hamilton, Sandro in Garnet Valley, Anthony in Middleborough, David in Villa Park, Jimmy in Cushing, David in Lenexa, Sorry, David and Lenexa was a $40 contribution. Thanks for that. John in Studio City, thanks for a $50 contribution. Thanks for a $60 contribution from Steven in New York. And thanks to Larry in Gainesville for a $100 contribution. Every single one of you and all of you as part of the premium program, you rock. And like I said, you can learn more about it at MacGeekGab.com/premium. So thanks for that. I think we're at the end, guys.
Thank you.
I think we... we're at the 120 mark. We have to let these fine people move on with their days. So it's time to find the band. My mouse is being weird. Oh, I have a piece of hair underneath my mouse.
Oh, wow. Throwing off the lasers.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big piece of fur, like right on the, I'm surprised it worked at all. That's that's quite a bit there. All right. Oh, look at that. It's so much better. Thanks for...
Siren turned off.
What's that?
The siren turned off, so I think I'm okay.
Okay. Did they accidentally run it? I mean, it was...
I think they may run it randomly occasionally, too, to make sure people are paying attention.
Keep you on your toes, maybe.
I have to double check that.
Yeah, I would double check that.
I think running it randomly would get people not to pay attention.
That's right.
Oh, they're just running it again.
Send in your questions to us at feedback@MacGeekGab.com, folks. We would love to hear from you.
Feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
I think you said feedback@MacGeekGab.com.
That's correct. Feedback@MacGeekGab.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear from you in our Discord. Thanks to everybody who participates there and helps each other out. It's not just us answering your questions in Discord. It's everyone. We get our own questions answered there. It's a wonderful community. I think we're up to about 1,500 people. We might have tipped the 2,000 mark. I actually haven't looked in a long time. Can I tell? Is that easy? I don't know. I can't tell from here. But thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks for everything. And yeah, check out our sponsors. Of course, you can always go to MacGeekGab.com/sponsors. They plus you, our premium listeners, are a real huge, like, that's the system that financially supports the show. And what really supports the show is all of you listening, participating, doing what you're doing. It's awesome. We're so fortunate to be part of this community. Got any advice for him, Adam?
Well, if there's a tornado coming or for any other reason, don't get caught.
Yeah.
Made up.
See ya. Later.